outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Chain. The God Chain. The God Chain.
Well, it's the old twofer. Kyle and I got talking last week, even after we shut off the podcast, and thought, you know what? We might as well just go ahead and tape this next one now instead of waiting, though. I'm sure lots could happen that would inform us even on this next time around. But, yeah, welcome back, Kyle.
I just wanted to thank you so much and just really appreciate the conversation that we had last week. And honestly, Wayne, as I've been thinking about it, I don't know if I have ever thought about self-control as a fruit of the Spirit. As I've just been reflecting on it, I think I have always viewed it as a spiritual discipline, as a Christian discipline, but not as something that God works out in my life, not as something that is a result of being won into the love of Christ.
And isn't that mostly true of all the fruits of the Spirit? Love, joy, peace, patience. You know, we look at all those things and say, okay, that's what the Spirit produces out of a journey. The whole Galatians 5 that it exists in is the law will not do anything. Love will be greater than the law. If you love, you'll follow the law. But if you try to follow the law, and Christians just took the fruits of the Spirit, we made another checklist.
Yeah.
You've got to act loving. You've got to act patient. You've got to, and I remember all that, trying to act loving, act patient, instead of really recognizing, no, this is what the Spirit produces out of us as we learn to follow, as we get inside that space of being loved and let that transformation go on in our heart. Then we find ourselves not acting like we love, but actually loving. Not acting patient, but actually having patience. And there's nothing wrong with me. When I look at my life, and patience has always been one of those things for me. I don't pray for it a lot because I know tribulation worketh patience, and I just... That's an old King Jimmy scripture in my head still, because that's where it got pounded into me. And people always, every time you enter, oh, isn't it great? God teaching you patience. No, it's not great. No, I don't like it. No, I don't think that's how it works. But as you get freer in his love, and then you can be in situations where, I'm now in situations where I've been called the most patient man on the planet. And I look at Sarah and watch her eyes roll because I know she knows better. I love that Jesus is letting that take shape in me. But there are those moments when I realize I'm not being patient, I'm not being gentle, I'm not being kind. And that's when I back off and just say, okay, the prayer I use for so many things, God, what is this about your love? I don't know that if I knew it, I could be patient with that person. I could be gracious to that person. I could have joy in this situation. Because to me, all that, if it's a fruit the Spirit produces out of love, then even when I realize I'm falling short of those things, it's not, I'm going to redouble my efforts. No, I'm going to lean inside Jesus and let more of that transformation happen. So that fruit rises out of me without my thinking about it, rather than I'm trying to act better, which even saying it that way just exhausts me. And I'm not even trying.
And then there's that other part of it. Well, you got to fake it until you make it. You know, you may not be feeling it, so you just got to act it. And then eventually God will catch up to you and you'll be actually living it out. You know, I can't. Oh, my gosh.
And how well has that worked? How well has that worked for any of us? Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't. But learning to let God transform that enough. I love the journey of that. I love that self-control is a fruit of the Spirit, as is love, as is patience, as is all those other things. And you can kind of get an indication of how well is my walk with Jesus going, but how well I'm living out some of that stuff. Not as an evaluation tool, just to explore.
Yeah.
God, what is it that would change my heart that way? Well, last week we promised we'd talk the social dilemma, never got to it. It's a documentary on Netflix about the social media part of our world and what it's doing to us. And I asked someone today, I had some time with, and I asked them if they'd seen it. And they said, you know, we watched 10 minutes of it and we're so depressed, we shut it off. Really? Oh my gosh, you need what's on there. It is depressing. Yes, there's a whole group of multinational corporations who are, for no other motive than to maximally monetize what they have, is destroying the culture we live in. Yeah. And because our Congress has and government has no willingness to stand up to those companies, in fact, they're owned by them themselves. No one gives more to lobbying campaign fees than these Facebook, Google, go down the list. And they want it protected. And yet the fruit of what they're doing, the technology, this is what it says on the website for the Social Dilemma. If you don't have Netflix, I'm sorry. And I know I got people who are, I cancel Netflix because they're running cuties. And
don't even get me started on that.
Yeah, you told me yesterday, you sent me a note saying, have I seen Cuties? And I'm like going, no, man, I don't have to watch it just because Netflix has it. And I hear it's a child porn thing. And no. And you made this comment of saying, this is what young girls deal with in our culture. And it's
absolutely,
and it's the over sexualization of young women in dress and movement and behavior as a way to compete with each other and compete for affection in the world. That's what it's about. And the knock on it I'd read, and this, I should know better than this. The knock I read on just child porn is going to encourage more pedophiles. That's what, no, it's not that film, is it? And I don't know that I'd recommend
it.
Not
even close.
It's a bad film. It's boring. It's not very engaging. But to see how young girls compete to be sexualized in the world breaks your heart. It just, oh gosh. And when you said that's because you work with these kids. That's your deal.
Yep.
And I go, if you're saying it, then I'm going to have a look at it. And I know I should do better than to trust. Because we had that with The Shack. People would say, man, I hate The Shack. Blah, blah. I'd say, did you read it? I go, no, I haven't read about it, heard about it. Yeah. That's not good enough. And maybe you don't want to watch Cuties. I'm not saying you should watch it. But I did because I wanted to say, okay, I've heard a lot of this. Is it really that? And it's not that. It's how our children are sexualized. And it's not just a world issue, is it?
No.
The church, this kind of stuff's going on among Christians just as much. The way, not just girls dress, the way women dress in our culture. Even mothers of kids, and I know it's not, I don't know what to say about it, because I don't think they really understand all the time, but the tight yoga pants, the, you know, sports bra, and do women have the right to dress that way if they want to? Yes, but you don't know what it's doing to the young girls who are watching, and to the men who have no control over their emotions and appetites. You don't know what it does.
That really comes back to the conversation we had last week about self-control. Because the thing that I appreciate about the Social Dilemma, about Cuties, about the political debate, the first debate that came up, each one of those is it uncomfortable? Absolutely. At times, is it grotesque? Absolutely. And yet it is a very blunt, honest, and transparent snapshot of what happens when we don't allow the fruit of the spirit, allow self-control to be a fruit of the spirit. And these are the byproducts of the decisions that we've made as a nation and as a culture and as a world. And is it ugly to look at? And does it make us squirm? Absolutely. And yet that's the world we live in. I mean, that's the norm. And we're all shaking our heads about this and saying, well, why is that? How could we be where we're at? Or how is this even possible? And it's like, did it happen overnight? No. But we're talking a long time of very subtle decisions that have created a culture that is fractured and broken and doesn't have any self-control.
And it's so massive that our hope of changing it seems so unrealistic. That I do think there's a whole lot of the ostrich approach to, I'm going to stick my head in the sand and I don't want to see it. I don't want to see it for what it is. And I think for me, you know, watching a very bad movie last night, because you said I probably should. and I think about the sexualization of children, which does fit right in with the Social Dilemma, because that's all a part of TikTok and girls dance and how they get noticed and how they get likes.
Absolutely.
And the more sexualized they are, the more likes they will get. And I just don't think people are aware of that. I got a granddaughter in dance and it's supposed to be just lyrical ballet, whatever. But when I went to one of the competitions before the COVID shut everything down, I saw a lot of dances that I'm going, man, for 11, 12 year old girls that are tarted up in makeup and dress, and moms think this is just so cute. And some of it is, some of it's innocent. I get that. But some of it pushes envelopes that make my heart hurt. Because I don't think, I don't think women are always aware. Their competition with each other degrades them in ways I don't think they realize. And and I'm saying they're responsible for men's temptations. I don't believe that. I think men are responsible for their own stuff. But I do think there's a mode of dress and tightness and that's become a norm.
Well, and I think you coming back to the comparison too, because I mean, let's throw out the whole, I mean, let's not even go down what the guy's impact is on this whole thing. Just what you were saying in regards to women and the expectations of women and how they're amongst other women. And
we're two guys talking about this. This is scary. We need a woman on here.
Oh, I know. We do.
I'm sure we're stepping on minefields we can't even see from here.
And I'm sure both of our inboxes are going to be blasted with this. But, you know, let's start the conversation and see where it goes from there. But, you know, Jess and I were just talking about this because there, you know, like I said, there was a young girl that we were in downtown Fort Collins. We're walking down the street and here comes a young girl and her dad. The girl's wearing a super tight leotard and a sports bra. And she was 11 or 12 years old. And nobody was even thinking twice about it. And they walk by and Jess pauses me and she's like, "Do you think Elle should wear something like that?" You know, we've been having these conversations of like, well, how are we going to raise our 10-month-old daughter? And you know, my wife was a professional dancer. She was a gymnast. You know, she definitely has dressed in attire that, it, you know, would be perceived as very racy or very, you know, however you want to describe it. But then there's the conversations that are taking place amongst women that I hear in my counseling office all the time, or I witness in the classroom. And they are brutal to each other because of the expectations that they're supposed to meet according to culture and trying to be TikTok famous, trying to be Instagram famous, trying to get more likes. And you're absolutely right. Most of them include trying to either sexualize or make themselves more vulnerable to culture in ways that, you know, that they walk away hurt. Like that's what I loved about, or not loved about, but one of the things that I appreciated about in the movie Cuties was one of the girls decides that she's going to post some nude images of herself on social media. And then all of a sudden there's all of this backlash that's taking place. And then it's threatening the friendships. And yet that was the cultural expectation and people were asking for them. But when the young person actually chose to go that route, then they're demonized and they're belittled. And I mean, it's just horrific.
And let's be clear. The boys were asking for the photos.
Oh, absolutely. Oh yeah. There were definitely boys asking for those photos. Absolutely.
And then to be liked.
But her comment was, as 11-year-old girl, was if we want them to see us as women, then this is how we're going to do it.
Yeah.
That was her comment. That was her defense of that.
Yeah. Let's get to the social dilemma. We're not here to discuss cuties, but we got a little bit of it. Social Dilemma is a documentary mostly voiced by creators of the very media they're criticizing. So this is not outside critics. These are people who actually worked on these platforms and who are no longer with these organizations because of what happened with their platforms. But on the website, it does this thing, the technology that connects us, and then underneath it that is the technology that controls us, the technology that manipulates us, the technology that monetizes us, and the technology that divides or polarizes us. So right out of the gate, they're saying, okay, this is the technology. It was supposed to connect us as humans. And that was the intent, I think, behind most of them. You get to share photos with friends. You get to connect with family, high school people you went to high school with. Yeah, all that. But as they ramped it up to monetize it, as Facebook, remember, didn't start monetized. It just started as a connecting tool. And people got on it. And I even noticed when I was first on Facebook and somebody make a comment on something I wrote, I would get an email that showed me the full content of what they wrote as a comment. Now I get three or four words and a dot, dot, dot. So I have to click on the platform. They're no longer serving me. They're serving their own needs to get as many eyes, because that's how their ad revenue is affected, by how many eyes see their stuff, click on their stuff, and even our social feeds. It used to be the people I wanted to see, I saw. Now it's the people Facebook thinks I'll want to see longer, linger on longer. So they're not even feeding me my friendships anymore. This just absolutely ticks me off. So there's four things that it gets to. It controls or manipulates us. And the word that comes up often is addictive. The apps, the search engines, the social media, the colors, the sounds, the likes are all to tickle our dopamine levels so that we'll keep coming back and cannot resist a phone that makes this wonderful little sound that says there may be something important for me over there. And how much these technicians, which is it's all algorithms. They're trying to figure out what gets Wayne on his phone and doesn't put it down. And that's what we're going to try to trick him into.
Yep.
Gosh. And that's why it says in the thing, most tech executives don't even allow their children to use their apps or even to use a smartphone. That's an amazing statement, because there is an element of this rewiring the human brain to be addicted to likes and comments and just sit for hours and hours and scroll down content looking for something that makes them feel something wonderful. And oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So it controls us by manipulating us. And what I think came out of the documentary that I thought was fascinating, not, oh, these guys in the evil lairs of Lex Luthor or somebody want to take over the world. They got together and said, let's build a platform that will addict people. Let's build a platform that will monopolize their time. What they actually did was they had this platform that was designed to connect people and share stuff, and then decided not just to monetize it, but to maximally monetize it, to make as much money as possible. Then it became about what gets people to stay on. And so algorithms and everything kept changing because it was this color, not that color. It was this sound, not that sound. I noticed today my watch, and I don't know when I gave an update to it, my watch makes a different tone to things than it used to make. Somebody changed it for me, because the other tone I've got used to ignoring. I don't respond to the tones in my phone. My phone's mostly on silent all the time because I don't want to be invited to it. I go to it when I need to. But now they've changed it, and I thought, well, that's an interesting tone. And I noted it, where the other tone I would have ignored. It would have just blown past me. But somebody now has decided to do it, and only because somebody decided we need to make as much money as possible from this device.
Without pausing to ask the question, should we? Or what is this going to do to society as a whole?
Yeah. Is this right? Is this good? Yep. Is this, yeah. No, because monetizing something is the only good to business.
Yeah.
Votes and power are the only thing good to politicians. It doesn't matter. And money's involved in that, obviously. But those bottom line things have warped our society to such a degree. When this COVID started, I've got a good friend in Ireland, and we were on a phone call, and he said, you know, when I watched this happen, and in the U.S., and I watched your rates rise when Europe was kind of toning down, and I heard in my heart, Babylon, Babylon, Babylon the Great has fallen. And I went, oh my gosh, that's prophetic language from Revelation. It's about the end of the age. And when I look at the Babylonian culture that it speaks to in Revelation, it describes the harlotries, the exporting sexual stuff around the world. It describes the U.S. as well as it describes anything. Going to war, being the strong, dominant Babylon, Babylon is fallen. And really said, this could be the time when U.S. society, with the way our culture's gone, with the division and polarization and sexual exploitation, maybe this is the time for judgment on America. And I'm telling you what, I don't know that he's right. I don't have a clue about that.
Yeah.
But if it is time, it's time. We have such a bottom line culture, whether it's money or votes or influence or whatever. That's, you know, we're talking about cuties. The girls dress the way they do because it gets them noticed by their peers. That's what it's about for them. They don't realize how much that is degrading them in other ways. So to manipulate us, to monetize us, and then this last bit, divide and polarize us. I just thought, wow. And even they show on there, and I asked my friend who said he didn't watch it, did you watch far enough to see the whole Google search thing and how that works? He goes, no.
Yeah.
So if you read a lot of conservative articles on live, those are the ones you touch when you search something or on Facebook or whatever. Then when you dump in Trump is into Google search engine, what you're going to get is a great president. Trump is a powerful man. Trump is, you're going to get all the, because they know that's what you're looking for. You'll click on that and you'll mm-hmm. read that article. And those people who've paid to have their thing put on Google want you to click on them. They don't care about what it is your point of view. But if you read more leftist kind of stuff and you put in it, Trump is, what Google's going to automatically complete for you is Trump is a fraud. Trump is a liar. Trump is a... And so these, what they call news or information silos, where if you're on the right, you get a certain set of news situations. And if you're on the left, you get another set of news, quote unquote, facts, that it's polarizing us into the very hatred. I saw a guy on CBS News last night, formerly worked for Facebook, I think, and he quit Facebook, and they asked him why he quit. And he says, because Facebook profits from hate. Hmm. Is that a statement?
Wow.
Gosh. Now, they didn't mean to. What they're trying to profit from is clicks. That's what they're trying to profit from. But trying to profit from clicks actually went to profiting from hate.
They're literally hacking into the most, almost the animalistic parts of the human brain.
Yes.
They're tapping into the core, raw fears, desires, passions, emotions that we are living in tension with every single day. And they're intentionally hacking those, designing to be able to draw those to the surface so that it's going to capture more of your time. And one of the things that they bring up in the social dilemma that just really is frightening to me is, so I'm not quite in the, so the iGen, which is the generation that's coming up after me, they live in a world where there has not been a consistent theme or a consistent story that everybody has agreed upon and then has different opinions about the same set of facts. They have grown up in a reality of information silos, of fake news, of an entire culture and society that's been manipulated for the sake of the bottom line. And what is that going to do to the human psyche? What is that going to make us believe about God? What is that's going to make us to believe about relationships, about life, about family, about culture? I mean, what is the impact going to be?
Well, we're seeing it now, aren't we? We're seeing the hatred, the inability to communicate with each other. Talking to my friend today, he said, we'll not talk about politics anymore. And I said, you know what? I'd appreciate the opportunity to talk politics with you. I don't have to make you agree with me. He said, well, I'm going to get you, I'm going to convince you you're wrong. And I said, well, if you do that, we're not going to talk much. But if we can just talk and share what you see and I share what I see, maybe we'll both learn something valuable. I think we're the ones that are going to have to say, we need to move away from the hatred these things are spawning toward. And when I watched the last 20 minutes of The Social Dilemma, I thought, if this is the problem, The Language of Healing is the cure. That book is exactly the opposing thing, which is not... Don't trust everything you get in the media to be true. Go meet people who are on the other side of this. I was talking to someone yesterday who's asking about us to do a Language of Healing presentation for this group of people that's doing peacemaking all over the world in an incredible way. I love what this organization is doing, at least on the surface. Hope it's not a knife media thing with what it's doing on the surface is not what's really going on underneath. I love what they're doing. They're asking, could we come alongside and help them explore that? And they talked about a group led by a black mother and a white cop that is talking about, they put this together because when they put groups together to share this, they want you to choose people that would normally opposites in this discussion. This one's in this silo, that one's in that silo. Now let's bring them together. And when a black mom, when a white cop can listen to the fears of a black mom and not be defensive, and when a black mom can listen to a white cop whose morale is being destroyed by this broad paintbrush that everybody's a racist. And if you could actually communicate at that level, to me, that's what the language of healing is meant to do, to get our information from people and their experience, yes, and realize that no one of us has an experience that is the sum total of all that's on the planet. I have an experience, you have an experience, and if we communicate that, we'll both grow. If we can't communicate, if my experience is right and your experience is wrong, we're never going to get anywhere.
And I love the distinction between that you just made, to go and find someone that would be in the camp that you wouldn't normally agree with. Because if you just go and do some research, I'm going to go and read what the left is reading, you're going to get the same stuff that you're getting from the right. You're going to get the same
the reaction type to it.
Yeah, exactly. The same type of agenda from the same information silos, whether it's from the left side or the right side. But I love the distinction. Go find a human being that you can have a genuine conversation
and listen to them. Listen when a black mom is terrified that her son could die if he engages the police, even if he's not done anything wrong. Now, we want to argue, and I heard my friend today, no, some of these, you know, black people actually resisting arrest and grabbing knives and guns, threatening police. Well, that, we're not talking about that. That obviously needs to be met with where the threat is disarmed. But we're talking about the innocent victims because of fear and because of a judgment of the other side, a judgment that we're feeding. So blacks are more fearful. White cops are more on alert because they're experiencing violence against them. So in ramping up the hate and the anger, we're actually making the situation worse because we can't sit down and talk about it and say, can you respect the difficult job that men and women of law enforcement have when they go into these tense situations? Can we respect that? Can we also respect the fact that there's a number of people who are too racially motivated to treat one group of people different than they treat another group of people? And that is a problem, needs to be ferreted out and held accountable. Both things can be true, but in this social dilemma world, both things can't be true. My side is all right, your side is all wrong. And we just don't have the ability to communicate that. And it's sad. What I came out of this with, as I watched The Social Dilemma, and none of these problems was I unaware of, other than how Google searches are manipulated, and other search engines too, probably, that they are manipulated to get you to poke on things that will keep you around more. And so they're feeding you the information you want rather than the information you need. That was a bit of a surprise. But I came away after we watched it, Sarah and I talked for a bit, and I'm just sitting there, what would I change about my social media habits having watched this? Mm. What would I change? What would self-control invite me to do as a fruit of the spirit? Do you want to go back to that? Honestly, I came away saying nothing. I wouldn't change a thing because I like the way I do social media. And that is, and here's how I describe it to anything. My whole journey is about, I don't want to be anybody else's tool. Maybe God's, but no one else's. So, and I don't think God uses me as a tool. So that helps with that. But I've never let my phone own me. I don't. I put it down significant amounts of time and put it away. Sometimes I'd be working in my office for 2-3 hours going, where's my phone? Make a phone call and realize it's still where I had lunch. I didn't miss it. I don't check it every few minutes. Like I said, I silence it. I usually turn it upside down. So if I get a text or something, I'm not distracted because I use my phone as a tool. I don't let my phone own me. I never let it use me. And I not that I never didn't, I'll be honest, because there were times when I feel like I am overly distracted by this thing. That's what's produced that. I don't want to be that distracted. I get the end of a day saying, wow, I spent more time playing that game, scrolling down that feed than I want to. And so I have already made changes before that. So that just gave me a greater hurt for what our society faces, for what kids face when they get addicted to that stuff. I watched my granddaughters, they were here the other night, stayed overnight, and we're in the bedroom talking and praying a minute before we go to bed. No, Sarah and I go to bed before the children go to bed. But we were talking about that. And my granddaughter's phone made this little tone, and I watched the dopamine kick in. I watch her face just light up. And her phone was, we didn't have the phones in her hand. It was on her bed upside down. She just lit up. Couldn't wait. Got to get to that. And I just go, oh my gosh. See, I don't want to live that way. So for a long time, I've just put it aside. And it does take a little bit of self. When I'm on Facebook, I intentionally don't look at ads and I don't click on sponsored content. I don't. Even if I'm intrigued, I'm kind of intrigued, but I'll Google that later. I'm not going to click on it because they're just going to give me more. And sometimes I sponsor stuff. So it's not that I, as a tool, I'm going to use Facebook. As a human being, I'm not going to let it use me. And so if people don't click on my links because they're sponsored, and we rarely do that, but if we do that, that's fine with me. I only do it when I feel like God says, I want this to go out a little wider, so make it more accessible. Because it used to go to everybody on that signed up to follow the God Journey or Livestream. Now it doesn't. If you like Livestream and you haven't gone over to Livestream and click that follow button or see first, you may never see something from me or the God Journey. If you go through over that little thing and click see first, then wow, okay, now it's going it's going to show up in your feed and you can fix it from there.
At times I feel like I'm playing with a hand grenade when I'm playing with social media. You know, there's been times where I've completely deleted all social media off of my phone to where the only time I can access it is if I'm on my computer, which I'm rarely on my personal laptop. I don't have it on my work computer and I don't have it on my phone. There was a season of time that I did that. There's definitely a season of time where I was struggling with more of just like anxiety and some depressive symptoms and that kind of thing. And so I noticed my screen time drastically went up, the amount of time that I was spending on my phone and how much I was using it or allowing it to dominate my time. And so I'm very aware that it has the addictive qualities that could suck me in. And so I've really wrestled with it. You know, I love it. I love the idea of using it as a tool. I like some of the connections that I can make on Facebook. I mean, some of the coolest relationships, God has actually used social media to connect me to people.
Absolutely. Me too.
I mean, there's a couple out of Wisconsin that I'm working with that are amazing. And the reason why I met them was because I responded to a post and they commented on my post. And that started a dialogue that's lasted 6 months now. And yet, you know, there's also those times where I intentionally completely remove myself from phone access. I'll put it away and I won't have it with me, or I'll go to places that have no cell phone service. So it doesn't matter. I just can put it away. I can leave my phone in the car and I can spend 2 or 3 days without ever even having to think about it because it doesn't work. So it doesn't matter.
And I like that people have a sense of whether this is healthy for me or not healthy. If I can use this as a tool, great. If it's using me as a tool, I take it off my phone for a while or hide my phone in a drawer. Or they make these lock boxes now where you can actually put your phone in a lock box and you can't get it for like 2 or 3 hours if you need that. I think it's great to be able to assess, is this valuable for me? Is this hurtful for me? And how do I make changes so that I can let this technology, which is absolutely incredible technology to connect people all over the world and to build relationships. And I don't think all social media relationships are shallow. I have some incredibly deep ones. The depth doesn't go on in the public space. It goes on in direct messaging and other kinds of things, or phone calls that come from it. But I really appreciate what this tool can do. At the same time, we have to have a healthy respect for how this tool wants to manipulate me.
Well, and that was something that they brought up in Social Dilemma, is you have hundreds of engineers, psychologists, and state-of-the-art AI that are all stacked up against you wanting to turn you into their slave.
Exactly.
And that's where their salaries come from. That's where their revenue comes from. That's their entire job description, is obtaining more of your attention.
Yep.
And so you definitely have to handle it with respect, like anything else. You know, I'm from Wyoming. I love firearms. I love guns. And
what's wrong with you?
And, you know, I grew up having to learn how to handle them responsibly. And, you know, they're a form of entertainment
and shoot Bambi's
and a form
mother?
Of joy, wow. I enjoy having a beer or enjoying a nice glass of scotch, but my parents don't, because they watched alcohol destroy the family members. Yep. And so they won't even go there.
And that's one of the things that I ask myself a lot. when I'm working with something, is this serving me or am I serving it? And that was true. That's what started the whole institutionalized religion thing and seeing the conformity dynamics and knowing that this was seeking to manipulate me. It wasn't part of a transformative engagement where Jesus gets to transform me and encouraging that. It was very much an imposed way that I should act, think, and talk that was more on the surface than it was in my heart. And I've seen that so much with just about anything that we do in America today. Somebody, a new business, a new service, a new app comes along, and it's got this great idea to serve you. And it does, actually. And then as you stay with it, all of a sudden, as they maximally monetize it, I don't know if that's an expression, but as we're going to get maximum monetization out of it, now all of a sudden, that dynamic changes. They sent me a product I really loved, and then they wanted me to sign up to a subscription, so they own me. And then then the product gets to be not as good as it was, and the service is not as good. So you have to work harder to get what you want. And now they flipped it all over where there's less service to me and more manipulation. And that's where I jump out of anything. I don't care if it's an app. I don't care if it's a razor that I ordered because it's going to be easier to get this stuff on the internet than go shopping for it. And then all of a sudden, now they don't exist for me. I exist for them. And they talk about loyalty and send these things and they're trying to get a new product. I don't use that product, but yeah, you got to go with the other products. And it just seems sad to me. I think businesses, I can't believe businesses can't make an honest living by serving the customer. Even the washing machines. We need to replace the washing machine. What? We only got it 7-8 years ago. That's how long they last. What?
Yeah.
They used to last 30 years. That's how they were built. Refrigerator lasts 30 years. You don't replace it. You just keep using it for what it is. And oh my gosh, it's just everything has gone to maximizing return, planned obsolescence. We're going to get in and manipulate you. That's why I go into a store, a grocery store, and they want my number to give me discount. You're going to give me a discount on my food so you can track what I purchased. No, you're not, because now you're using me.
Yep.
All the things we get now to evaluate our experience with that phone caller, that worker in the store. Now you're asking me to serve your company. I'm your customer. You evaluate your worker. Don't ask me. I just blow all that stuff off. Because the question I ask is this serving me, which is what a business should do, or am I serving it? And once I start to serve it, I'm out. I don't have time for you. And I'd rather lose a good service because now you're manipulating me than I would to keep being manipulated. And yet every business goes, everything becomes worse. Every app I've got became worse when they monetized it.
Yeah.
It's more intrusive. It doesn't work as well. It takes more of me to navigate around it. It takes me to go into the settings and turn off the notifications and turn off that stuff so you're not bothering me when I don't want to be bothered. If I want to come and check you, I will come and check you. But no, you're not going to sit there and say, check me, oh, check me now, check me, check me. I'm not putting up with it. And I guess I'm just stubborn enough. So that's why when I got done, I'm going, you know what? I like how I handle social media. It's a part of my day. It's a part of what we use at Lifestream or God Journey to get the word out to people who want it. But I've even seen, you know, Christian relational websites go from, hey, we're just here to help you serve, to we're creating a community, and now we want you to commit to this, and we're going to be involved with that, and now you can get a subscription to my audio or my... Now it's, again, we're not serving you. You're serving us.
Now you're our product, and we're selling it well to you.
I hope more people kind of get turned on to that. The harder thing, I think, with all the social media stuff is how do you teach your kids?
Yes.
And I look at that with my grandkids and daughter. I told my daughter, you guys need to sit down and watch social media together. Your kids need to get a fix. And she manages their screen time, I mean, like the Gestapo sometimes. She's not take your device and do whatever you want, whenever you want. But I don't know that everyone realizes how addictive those companies are making that, and specifically stuff aimed at children. They can't stop playing Minecraft or Roblox or whatever because they just keep adding bells and whistles, and you've got stuff where you're competing, and then you've got it just keeps drawing your eyes to us.
Yeah.
And that just got to stop.
I think, again, it can be a tool you know, I like the tablet and watching a movie on it, or, you know, streaming something off of Netflix when you're on a road trip. I think some of those things are great. But again, you know, looking at, we were talking a lot about also how this is impacting culture and decisions that we're making. And unfortunately, a lot of the work that I'm doing with the teens that I work with, and even some of the elementary students that I work with, families, for a whole host of reasons, are so disengaged and so fractured that, I mean, you know, like it, the ease of just handing them a tablet and saying, here, play this game, stay out of my way, I'm so stressed, I've had to work 3 jobs to make ends meet, and, you know, for, I mean, a whole plethora of reasons. Yep. And yet that's just not even a norm for families to sit down and have a conversation to, you know, and yet in the classroom, I can tell the students very, very easily that either have no social media or have severe, like significant restrictions on their screen time, in the maturity level, in their emotional regulation, in their ability to relate with other people, in their ability to respect and relate to adults, their studiousness. It's blatantly obvious.
That's what I love about the social media thing, your social dilemma, because what it asks is, at what cost?
Exactly.
Valuable tools, wonderful resources at our fingertips, but at what cost? And it's up to us, back to self-control, to keep the cost down. And I don't mean the financial cost, but all that you just mentioned about our ability to engage others, our ability to have an attention span outside needing the bells and whistles and colors to keep my attention. So hopefully we'll have more conversation about this from other folks going to help us chime into it. Absolutely. It helps them not be a tool to big media.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.